This is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
It is, and you're about to be presented with, for your consideration, one of the greatest minds in the world today, Dr. Michio Kaku. He is an internationally recognized authority in theoretical physics and the environment. He holds the Henry Summit Professorship in Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, has lectured round the world, and his PhD-level textbooks are, in fact, required reading at many of the top physics labs worldwide. Dr. Kaku graduated from Harvard in 1968, summa cum laude, number one in his physics class at that, received his PhD from the University of California at Berkeley Radiation Laboratory in 1972, held a lectureship at Princeton University in 73, then joined the faculty at the City University of New York, where he has been a professor of theoretical physics for now 25 years. His goal is to help complete Einstein's dream of a theory of everything. That would be a single equation, perhaps no longer than 1 inch, like your thumb. A little shorter, actually, which will unify all the fundamental forces in the universe. Coming up in just a moment. Well, first of all, Dr. Kaku, welcome to the program.
Glad to be back, Art.
Oh, it's so nice to have you here. It really is. It's always just a blast. Before we get into what we're going to talk about, I've got a couple of listener kind of questions that I'd like to try and pummel you with and just see what your reaction is.
Away.
We've talked about quantum this and quantum that on the show a lot of times. And so this listener wants to know from you if a quantum bomb, always thinking about stuff blowing up, right? But if a quantum bomb would be theoretically possible, and if it is, this listener suggests that it would be of such a magnitude that it would collapse all dimensions around us and create what he calls an infinite chain reaction. That's pretty scary. I mean, is such a thing even possible?
Well, you know, quantum mechanics is basically the theory of the atom, otherwise known as atomic physics or nuclear physics. And we already use quantum mechanics to create the atomic bomb. The atomic bomb is a direct consequence, not only of E equals MC squared, but of the quantum theory devised in the 1920s and 1930s. So in that sense, the atomic bomb and the hydrogen bomb are quantum bombs. However, this person is trying to hint that perhaps there's a bomb that could shatter space and time itself.
That's right, yes.
And at the present time, we know of no such thing. Even a black hole, for example, which would contain perhaps the largest concentration of energy in our sector of the galaxy, even a black hole does not set off a chain reaction. Now, remember that Einstein himself, back in the 1920s, speculated that E equals MC squared may be able to make a bomb, but he didn't understand the chain reaction process back in the 1920s. That allows you to magnify a very tiny amount of energy into a bomb. Now, even though we have black holes, in fact, we've now seen a few hundred of them with the Hubble Space Telescope and perhaps hundreds of thousands with the Chandra X-ray telescope,
mm-hmm.
We know of no mechanism that can create a chain reaction. That is, one black hole setting off another black hole setting off another black hole. So I think for the present time, we have to rest assured that there's no such thing as a quantum bomb. However, an antimatter bomb, that would be perhaps the largest source of energy release that you could create with modern technology, perhaps 100, 200 years in the future.
Can we even speculate on what would happen if somebody set off an antimatter bomb?
We could speculate. A teaspoon of antimatter combined with ordinary matter would give you up to 100% energy efficient conversion, and that would be enough to blow any modern city off the face of the Earth. If you had antimatter, for example, the size of a good house or an apartment house, that'd be enough perhaps to crack the Earth in half.
So then, Well, let me ask you this. Antimatter, suppose we had a teaspoon of it. Would we then concoct it into a bomb, physically following the design of the current bomb, where, you know, you've got two balls of what, plutonium, and you smash them together, right?
Mm-hmm.
At a very high speed. Well, if you had antimatter and matter, would you do essentially the same thing, just suddenly bring the two together? And before I can even ask that, how would you contain the antimatter in anything to thrust it toward the matter?
Yeah, well, there is a difference. With ordinary atomic bombs, you need critical mass. This is what Hitler did not understand back in the 1930s and early 40s. He did not understand one number which could have determined the fate of World War II.
One number?
That one number is the amount of uranium or plutonium necessary to sustain a chain reaction.
Uh-huh.
Today we know that it is about 20 pounds of uranium and perhaps half that of plutonium. So, but Hitler didn't know that number. He thought it may be tons of enriched uranium. So he shelved the atomic bomb project and instead went for the V-2 project and the V-1, that is the ballistic missile and the cruise missile. So luckily, Hitler did not know that number, or else he may have tried to have a crash program to build the atomic bomb.
How did we figure out that number?
Well, we, on the other hand, had reactors, and we could play with certain amounts of plutonium. And we knew the rate, the cross-section, the rate at which uranium fissions. That's what the Germans did not know. They did not know what is called the effective cross-section. Werner Heisenberg, of the famous Heisenberg uncertainty principle,
mm-hmm.
Was the one who essentially goofed the debriefing after 1945 when the Allies captured Werner Heisenberg. The debriefing papers have now been pretty much declassified. You can read them. And we realized that when he was debriefed after being captured, Heisenberg did not know that number. The first thing he asked was, what was the size of the carrier of the Hiroshima bomb? That was the first thing he asked.
Huh.
He didn't know whether it was a ship or not. When he was told that it was a B-29 bomber, he knew the size of the bomb bay, and therefore he estimated the size of the bomb. And then mentally he worked backwards. He worked backwards in his mind as he was being interrogated to figure out what the neutron cross-sections were for the atomic bomb. He essentially did not know the answer. He goofed. Luckily,
but we essentially gave him the answer in interrogation.
That's right. Once we told him the size of the Hiroshima bomb, being the genius that he was, he mentally computed backwards. He thought a gigantic ship would be required to deliver an apartment-size atomic bomb on an enemy. He didn't realize that an atomic bomb, the plutonium and uranium, is basically the size of your fist.
Hmm.
Now, an antimatter bomb does not have critical mass. Any amount of antimatter would instantly combine and release enormous amounts of energy.
Well, how can it even theoretically exist on Earth where everything is virtually matter and whatever you try to contain it with would be matter?
Yeah, that's the problem. Right now, we can create beams of antiprotons in a vacuum and then combine them with anti-electrons coming from a radioactive source called sodium-22. And we get anti-hydrogen. So this has been done in the laboratory. We have actually created small quantities of anti-hydrogen gas. If the anti-hydrogen gas combines with ordinary matter, then of course it immediately annihilates. However, these are infinitesimal quantities. You would have to do this in outer space. In outer space, you would have to have a laboratory sufficient to create beams of these things, which would not interact with matter. But then, you would have to put it into a bottle of some sort.
Right.
A container.
Right.
So that you don't blow yourself up before the bomb does. With plutonium, you do this by having subcritical masses or subcritical pieces of uranium. The Hiroshima bomb, for example, basically looked like Pac-Man, a large piece of uranium with a pie piece taken out. And you shot the pie piece into the larger assembly, and the subcritical pieces went supercritical. So that's how the Hiroshima bomb worked. Basically, look at a gun principle based on shooting a Pac-Man pie piece into the larger Pac-Man. But, however, an antimatter bomb simply would disintegrate as soon as you form it.
Do you remember in, what was it, Fat Man and Little Boy or whatever it was, the movie about the making of the bomb?
That's right.
Do you remember that scene in the lab where somehow they made a mistake and they got and I guess this is all a true story, and they got critical masses too close together.
That's right.
And away she went, and he was radiation poisoned, died a terrible death and all the rest of it in the making of the bomb. Well, was that essentially what we're talking about here, the size of the mass and how close it gets and all that?
That's right. Two people were actually blown apart and were killed at Los Alamos. One was killed 1 month after the bombing of Nagasaki. They had the plutonium on a tabletop, believe it or not. They had the atomic bombs.
How much of it, Doctor?
Again, about the size of your fist. They had two hemispheres of plutonium. And Harry Daglian, a 26-year-old worker, walked into the room where they had this atomic bomb sitting on a tabletop. And he tripped. He tripped, and his shoulder hit the tungsten carbide, which was surrounding the plutonium. The tungsten carbide fell into this mass, reflected the neutrons, concentrated the neutrons, and critical mass was attained right in his face. So we have to realize that a small atomic bomb went off right in front of Harry Daglian's face.
Well, there was an actual physical explosion, because they didn't show that, of course, in the movie. They just showed the radiation going off scale and stuff. Was there actually any physical notable reaction, or was it all radiation?
It was all radiation.
It
was a blue flash of light called Cherenkov radiation.
Oh, there was?
There was a blinding blue flash of light called Cherenkov radiation of neutrons. Harry Daglian was hit with about 5,000 rads of radiation.
Wow.
That is an enormous amount of radiation. That's 10 times what's necessary to kill you. So he got a tremendous dose of radiation, and he died in the Los Alamos hospital within a matter of days to weeks.
I assume he knew what had just, you know, I mean, he knew he was a dead man walking.
That's right. He didn't feel a thing. He didn't feel a thing, even though every cell in his body was being ripped apart.
Except intellectually. He could read the meters.
That's right. He lost consciousness after about an hour or so, and then his body basically disintegrated. Radiation burns all over his body. There are autopsy reports published of this, which I have. Huge blisters occurred over his body. And then just a few months later, believe it or not, in 1946, Louis Slotin, a physicist, was blown apart in the same way. He had two hemispheres of plutonium on a tabletop. He had an atomic bomb on the tabletop with a screwdriver. The screwdriver would bring these two hemispheres closer and closer and closer together. A Geiger counter needle would go off scale, and then he would untwist, unscrew the two hemispheres. This is called tickling the dragon's tail. Slowly with a screwdriver, bringing two subcritical pieces of plutonium, which could detonate as an atomic bomb. In fact, as far as we know, that same mass of plutonium was, in fact, detonated in the Pacific.
That could have happened on the tabletop. Now, it was always my understanding from the movies, where else would I get it, that you had to create a TNT-type or level explosion to slam these two pieces.
That's if you want to release 20,000 tons of TNT. If you just want to set off criticality, that is, have a blinding blue flash and basically fry anybody in the room,
yes,
you could do that by bringing them together with a screwdriver.
All right. The next question would be, didn't they at that time understand enough of the theory to understand what they were doing to themselves, potentially?
Well,
I mean, they had to know.
They considered themselves hot rodders. They were pushing the laws of physics. They were making measurements. And when Slotin realized that he had turned the screw too many times and the Geiger counter needle went off scale, he lunged forward and with his bare hands, he separated the two plutonium hemispheres and he took the entire brunt of the atomic bomb in his chest.
Oh, my God.
And he was, again, hit with about 5,000 rads of radiation. He, too, pretty much disintegrated with enormous burns over his body at the Los Alamos Hospital.
Well, Professor, he wouldn't have been informed enough about the tail tickling to not do this?
Well, this was an accident. He knew that if you brought the two hemispheres too close together, the neutrons would hop across,
yes,
and subcritical mass would become supercritical. However, he never expected that he would make a mistake. there was a beryllium cup, a reflector. He made a mistake with regards to turning the screw too much with the reflector. Too many neutrons were going back and forth between the two hemispheres, fissioning the plutonium atom, and it went supercritical in its case. Believe it or not, 7 Americans have been literally blown apart in supercriticality accidents.
Seven Americans.
Yeah, you often hear that no one's ever died in a nuclear accident.
That's baloney, huh?
Which is baloney, because I have the autopsies of many of these individuals. We physicists study these things, because we have to understand what happens when reactors blow up and what happens when bombs explode in your face. And again, these same hemispheres of plutonium apparently were detonated in the Pacific as an atomic bomb.
Sure. But again, back in the lab, Professor, how wide a geographic swath of the kind of radiation that killed them was created? In other words, people in the same room, people in adjacent rooms, or could it have been much worse, getting them closer together, something that, for example, would have killed everybody on the base that they were experimenting?
Well, luckily, both incidences had the plutonium coming together very slowly. One because of the heating of a tungsten carbide block, and the second because a screwdriver was turned too much.
Yes.
And so in the room, there were several people watching this demonstration by Lewis Slotin. Each of them got a pretty hefty dose of radiation, but all of them survived, except for Lewis Slotin himself, who, as I said, disintegrated in the hospital. But the other individuals got a heavy dose of radiation, but there were no side effects. They were far enough from the plutonium so that they survived. When I was a graduate student, by the way, in physics, we heard rumors about this incident, and we were told that in the first week, the first row died. In the second week, the second row died. In the third week, the third row died, according to the inverse square law. That's not true. I looked up the report, and the only person who died was Lewis Slotin in this second incident. However, you know, the military is quite careless with regards to plutonium. They often wash large quantities of plutonium waste in pipes, and sometimes you have criticality in the walls of the building.
Really?
I was shocked. At the Y building at Oak Ridge, Tennessee, you can actually look up the file, where critical mass was attained in the wall.
Wow.
And people walking in and out were hit with a fair amount of radiation as liquid, in and out, went critical and went out of critical, went in and critical, out of critical, over a period of hours.
But still in all, people doing that kind of work are required, are they not, to wear badges that would have reflected the dose they were getting, wouldn't they?
Well, believe it or not, in order to reconstruct the dose, they put a donkey in that same room. And they had the donkey be exposed to critical mass from the wall to calculate exactly how much radiation the workers got.
Huh.
This is how careless. You'd be shocked when you read the files.
But again, they weren't wearing dosimeters?
Some of them were, some of them weren't. And it was not, you know, it was, again, wartime security and people, I mean, post-war security. People were very lax about these kinds of things. And, well, I mean, like, for example, in 1961 in Idaho, there was a worker who manually removed the control rod out of the SL-1 reactor, the stationary low-power reactor unit 1, and the reactor went supercritical right under his feet, and the reactor exploded.
I've never heard any of this.
Yeah, this is Idaho Falls, Idaho, January 1961. Three workers were blown apart when a reactor went supercritical. Forget the meltdown. We're talking about a small bomb going off right under the feet of Mr. John Burns, who was shot through the ceiling. The explosion was so great that the control rod went right through his body and impaled his body on the ceiling of the reactor.
Oh, God. I haven't heard any of this. Professor, hold on. We're at the bottom of the hour. I haven't heard any of this. Have you all? Have you heard these stories before? I certainly haven't. Aye, aye, aye. What a beginning. I'm Art Bell.
To talk with Art Bell, call the Wildcard Line at area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll-free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
It is, and I've loved this song ever since the movie, The Stand. You remember the first couple of minutes of the movie of The Stand when there was the biological big oops? And they played this piece of music as an opening. I thought it was superb. And there are so many places where it fits into a show just like this. Good evening. I'm Artford George. My guest is Professor Michio Kaku. And Professor, let's go right back to this incident. I'm just curious as I can be why anybody would march into a reactor room, grab a rod, and pull it out. I mean, what would drive a person to do that in the first place?
Well, Mr. John Burns, back in January of 1961, was sitting on top of the stationary low-power reactor, Unit 1, operated by the United States Navy.
Yes.
And he was told never, ever remove central control rod number 9 more than 6 inches.
Right.
Because if you remove the control rod, which regulates the chain reaction, dampens the chain reaction, if you remove central control rod number 9 more than 6 inches, the reactor would go supercritical, and it would, in fact, explode.
That seems like an extremely serious warning.
That's right.
Yes.
You would get supercriticality, heating would occur, water would boil, and the boiling water would then create a steam explosion, which would blow the whole thing apart.
Very bad. Yes.
Well, that's what happened. Reconstructions of the accident show that he tampered with central control rod number 9 and removed it 2 feet. 2 feet out of the reactor.
Do we have any idea why he would do something with such a strong warning attached to it? Why would he do that?
Well, first of all, we have to realize that reactors will blow up under certain conditions. It's often stated that reactors do not blow up like Hiroshima bombs. No, they don't blow up like Hiroshima bombs, but they do blow up like Chernobyl, like
yes.
SL1.
Right.
It will explode, steam explosion, hydrogen gas explosions
right.
created by supercriticality will blow a reactor and blow the roof right off.
Gotcha.
There are two theories. The dominant theory is that he slipped. He was making routine repairs. And he slipped. It was New Year's. It was right after New Year's. He was probably a little tipsy, and removed the rod and then slipped, and it jerked 2 feet out of the reactor, blowing him to pieces. I mean, it shot him right through the ceiling of the reactor. He was impaled.
Yeah, you said he was impaled by the rod itself, and it hit the ceiling. Well, then what?
Then reactor safety crews went into the reactor site to find out what happened. They found that radiation levels were about 1,000 rads an hour. 500 rads will kill you. It was 1,000 rads an hour.
Oh, okay.
Just a few minutes in that site, you would get already the year's maximum dose of radiation.
Right.
And they found 2 dead bodies on the ground, and they looked for the third. They made repeated entrance into the reactor looking for the third. Finally, according to the report, one of the workers looked up and saw the third body, John Burns, impaled on the ceiling. There is a second theory that proponents of nuclear power like to make, and that is that John Burns was involved in a love triangle, and that he wanted to commit suicide and therefore blow one of the other rivals, also of the kingdom come. And so he was apparently distraught and blew himself and his co-workers that were his rival to bits using a nuclear power plant to do it. The point I'm raising is that...
Do you favor one theory over the other, by the way?
Well, it was New Year's. It was January 2nd at 9 o'clock at night. And it was possible he was still suffering a hangover from New Year's. And so it's certainly possible that he could have slipped and set the whole thing into motion. But, you know, we have to realize that, you know, nuclear power plants can become unstable. They don't simply melt like Three Mile Island. They can explode like Chernobyl. They can explode like the SL1. And they can go supercritical. And that supercriticality accidents are more common than you realize.
Well, all right. Here's one from Ray C., who is able to fast blast me, you know, a little computer message while I'm doing the show, from Wasilla, Alaska, who says, "Hey, Art, ask Dr. Kaku about the day we almost lost Detroit when the only commercial fast breeder reactor, a Fermi 1, built in the U.S., partially melted. Is that true?"
That's right. This was kept hush-hush in the 1960s, but Three Mile Island was not our first meltdown. Our first meltdown was Fermi 1, operated by Detroit Edison.
Really?
And it was a 2% core melt, 2% of the core melted. I have pictures of the core showing melted, these melted rods of uranium dripping fuel down to the bottom.
Yikes.
What happened was it was a breeder reactor, which today would be considered criminal to operate. These are very unstable reactors. They operate on highly enriched uranium, 20% enriched uranium.
I didn't even know we had any active breeder reactors. I thought that was just, well, or if we did, they were lab experiments ongoing, not anything full-scale running.
No, it was a commercial breeder reactor everyone wants to forget because it melted and created a potential catastrophe.
Dumb me. I hadn't even heard about it. I thought it was only in the lab where I would see scientific reports every now and then. Aha, we have created this kind of reaction, or it can be created, but to have a full-scale model operating, I had
a
no
commercial
idea.
One.
No. Oh, no, no
it,
idea.
Today it would be considered criminal if anyone tried to make a commercial breeder reactor. They're very unstable. The very first breeder reactor, the EBR-1, actually melted back in the 1950s. It was one of the first major melts of a nuclear reactor. They were able to stabilize it about 1 second before it would have exploded. Then in the 60s, they had a commercial, not an experimental, a commercial reactor.
Well, how did that happen? I mean, how did we get a commercial reactor? If it's something that's not even safe in the lab, for God's sakes, how could it get built as a commercial reactor?
Well, they were cowboys in those days.
Man, I guess.
Yeah, they thought they were pushing the envelope, and that they were the cowboys that were going to tame the atom.
Well, yeah, but if you can't contain this thing in the lab, how can you build something commercially based on what?
Well, you can't, but they did.
But they did. Oh,
Detroit Edison
my.
Built a sodium cool. Sodium is quite volatile. They use not water, but sodium. What happened was a piece of zirconium, a piece of metal about the size of a beer can, became dislodged in the cooling system, jammed the cooling system. The reactor overheated as a consequence and began to melt. And then radiation alarms were sent off. They immediately stopped the chain reaction. And for days, they were wondering, what is the state of a melted core? They had never seen a commercial reactor with a melted core before. And so they simply crossed their fingers. They literally crossed their fingers and hoped it wouldn't become supercritical.
Uh-huh.
It was 20% enriched, highly enriched uranium. Today we use only 3% enriched uranium, by the way.
A
bomb is 90% enriched.
Could it have gone?
It might have gone. There was speculation. That's why they flew in top-flight scientists to try to recreate how much melted fuel there was in that reactor to see whether the melted fuel would combine to give you critical mass.
Well, would this fast blast be overdramatic the day we almost lost Detroit, or could it have been that bad?
It could have been bad because of two things. One, melting could have started up again, in which case you would have a sodium explosion, which is quite volatile. Sodium will explode on contact with, like, water. A sodium explosion, which would rip the whole reactor apart, or a small bomb. That is, supercriticality would be attained with melted fuel, and then it would heat up, and then again another sodium explosion to rip the reactor apart. Anyway, what they did was they got a long tube, and they sent it into the reactor with a small TV camera attached to the end of it. Take photographs of the bottom.
Right.
This is the first time they've ever done this, by the way. Everything was by the seat of your pants.
I guess.
They had never done this before, shooting a TV camera right into the core of a melted reactor. And, you know, there were evacuation plans to evacuate large portions of Detroit.
Were they?
It was a sodium explosion.
Were they telling the people of Detroit what was going on at the time?
They heard nothing. I got the file from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission once, years ago, and there was a letter from the union, the United Auto Workers Union, saying that some of the union brothers have heard that there was a massive incident at the reactor. Could you clarify?
Yes.
And the answer is also there in the file. The answer says, oh, nothing happened.
Oh.
And yet we had America's first meltdown back in the mid-1960s, a commercial reactor that spun out of control, in which case portions of Detroit may have had to be evacuated.
Uh-huh.
And you could visit Fermi 1 today, by the way.
What kind of heat was developed in a breeder reactor situation?
Well, breeder reactor is called hard nuclear. The hardest of the nuclear reactors are breeder reactors. They operate on very enriched fuel. That's why the Japanese and the French are getting so much criticism, because they ship breeder fuel by ships. Someone could hijack the fuel and conceivably build a small bomb out of the fuel.
Yes.
The fuel is highly enriched. Like I said, Fermi was 20% enriched. An atomic bomb is 90% enriched. Commercial reactors are 3% enriched. And so they ship highly enriched plutonium in a react and uranium fuel rods by boat. And so Greenpeace and many environmentalists have stated that this is a disaster waiting to happen if someone hijacks a shipment of breeder fuel.
Sure.
In the United States, it was canceled. The Clinch River was an experimental breeder reactor built after the commercial one melted.
What? How many breeder reactors operate in the world?
Well, in the United States, Clinch River was canceled by President Carter. Okay, he canceled Clinch River, realizing that it was very experimental. Two breeders had melted. The first one, EBR-1, melted in the 50s. The second one, a commercial one, melted in the 60s.
Yes.
And Jimmy Carter then said, enough is enough.
Enough, but so not here. But I mean worldwide.
Well, the French had the Phoenix, a breeder reactor. And, in fact, there was one misguided environmentalist who aimed a bazooka at the Phoenix, just to show how vulnerable the Phoenix reactor and the Super Phoenix are to terrorism. And because the fuel is highly enriched, they're shipped right through commercial lanes, and people are very afraid that these reactors could get out of control. In Japan, it's the Monju. In France, it's the Phoenix. And again, these operate on highly enriched fuel, and they can, in fact, sustain supercriticality accidents rather easily.
So there are two of them?
Several that are in the commercial domain. Other small countries may be doing this experimentally, but those are the two most famous, the Super Phoenix in France and the Monju in Japan.
That's amazing. I had no idea these things were going on. I thought it was all just in the lab, that there was not commercial application yet for breeders. I don't know why I believe that, but I did.
Well, the one in Japan is still, of course, ongoing. However, the point here is that these guys are hot rodders. They're cowboys, and they build these damn things, and they want to commercialize it and put them in people's backyard. Even though basic meltdown and basic supercriticality tests have not been done on these reactors. You know, airplanes are crashed. We have lots of experience on crashed airplanes. We have very little experience on crashed reactors.
Right.
And as a consequence, when one of these reactors spin out of control, it's the seat of your pants.
Actually, I've seen a couple of 60 Minutes pieces on Chernobyl, and they're pretty grim. I mean, they built this sarcophagus around it, and that appears to be, according to reports I've seen, deteriorating, and I've heard some pretty grim things.
Yeah. Every time it rains in Kiev, water seeps into the concrete sarcophagus and moderates the neutrons, as they're called. And you can actually see radiation levels rise. It's actually in a working reactor in totally melted form, rising and falling with the rainfall.
What's the deal with Chernobyl? I mean, how long are we going to have to deal with this damn mess anyway?
Perhaps centuries. And, you know, it's still melting. The accident hasn't stopped at all. The laws of physics keep on going.
I understand.
Very hot core. It's melting through the concrete, and at a certain point, it'll go right through the concrete.
Then what?
And then it'll hit groundwater. And then, you know, there's a concern that it could cause a steam explosion. And like I said, you can actually see neutron levels rise every time it rains and water seeps into the sarcophagus. The geometry of the core is unknown. We do not know what the geometry of the core is. So just like at Fermi 1, We have melted fuel in an unknown geometrical configuration. If it concentrates in one area, you could have supercriticality, not like a Hiroshima bomb, but more like what happened to Lewis Slotin and the Harry Daglian in 45 and 46. And then you would have heating, then perhaps a steam explosion, which will blow the whole thing apart. And so this is something that is still of concern, that reactor is unstable.
All right. Assuming it does go on and melt down, I'm speaking now of Chernobyl, to the groundwater, and you get a steam explosion, what kind of magnitude and results from that would we expect?
This would be catastrophic in the sense that all the fission products, all the waste, the nuclear waste, would then be shot into the sky. And then as fine dust, the winds would then blow it downwind and contaminate large areas. Now, the greatest nuclear accident of all time before Chernobyl actually took place in Russia in the 1950s in the Ural Mountains. It was the greatest nuclear catastrophe of all time, and it too was hushed up. All these accidents have been hushed up.
What happened there?
Well, in the area called Kushtin, near the village of Kazli, there was a plutonium dump. Stalin had all the excess plutonium from the nuclear program dumped into this one site.
Uh-huh.
And apparently, again, supercriticality was achieved and boiling occurred within the plutonium dump. And an explosion took place which blew the lid right off the container. And plutonium in liquid aerosol form shot into the atmosphere. And the CIA knew that a big one had happened in Russia.
Yes.
Because all of a sudden in the literature.
I remember muted reports of this.
That's right. The CIA was onto it. What happened was in the scientific journals, the Russians were all of a sudden writing reports about the transport of plutonium through, aqueous environments.
Yes.
That is, contaminated lakes.
Right.
And people said, why would the Russians contaminate their own lakes
with
plutonium? This is outrageous. And so the CIA said either it was a bomb that went off accidentally, a reactor that went crazy, or a waste dump accident. And, after the Soviet Union broke apart, the files became declassified. And we know now that it was a waste dump accident. This was the mother of all nuclear accidents before Chernobyl. About 20,000 curies of radiation were lofted into the atmosphere as a consequence. Even today, when railroads go past that area, the conductors would put the shade down so you can't see what's outside. Whole villages had to be evacuated. If you look at the census charts, all of a sudden certain villages just disappear off the census chart in that area. So we know it was a big one. We know that quite a bit of radiation went into the atmosphere. And Roy Medvedev, a Russian dissident, actually wrote a book.
Do we have any idea how many people were actually killed, evacuated, and never to be used again in our lifetimes?
Probably tens of thousands were evacuated out of that area and were contaminated. How many died, we don't know. I imagine now that the files are being declassified in Russia, that probably we can get more detailed estimate of how many people died as a consequence of the Kushtin accident.
Certainly we would want that kind of information, wouldn't we?
That's right. And by the way, England, about the same time, sustained its first big nuclear accident, which was totally hushed up in England. This was the Windscale, pile number one in the 1950s. It was actually very much like the Chernobyl accident. It was carbon-moderated. The carbon caught on fire, and you had a uranium-carbon fire in the center of a nuclear power plant in Windscale, England. They had never seen this before. A reactor actually inflames. The workers shot hose water directly into the core of a nuclear power plant. This is unbelievable. I mean, you have to read the files to believe it.
How could...
a huge explosion took place. Gigantic amounts of gas was lofted in the air.
I'm sure.
And the Queen scientists tracked that radioactive cloud sailing over the English Channel. And they classified the whole thing. Only the Queen of England. She was the only civilian to be aware of this accident.
Professor, rest for a moment. We're at the top of the hour. Just totally blown away would be the way I would describe this last hour. Some of it I had heard a little bit about. but almost everything we had this last hour, I had no idea about. Did you? Absolutely incredible stuff. Well, from an incredible guy. Professor Michio Kaku is my guest from the high desert in the middle of the night, the right time. This is Coast to Coast AM.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, dark say goodnight, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world. The colors of the rainbow, so pretty in the sky, are also on the faces of people going by. I see friends shaking hands, saying, how do you do? They're really saying, I love you. I hear babies cry. I watch them grow. They're like much more.
To talk with Art Bell, call the Wildcard line at area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll-free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call Art at 800-618-8255.
You know,
international callers may reach Art Bell by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5. And dialing toll-free 800-893-0903.
You know,
from coast to coast and worldwide on the internet,
Ross.
This is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
Yeah, I wanted to squeeze in a little bit about that record. There's times when you just sort of let that one go and soak it in, and the times when you're talking about things like this. This is incredible stuff. Stuff I've never heard, I'm sure many of you have never heard. And I guess something you want to make note of, because of course it's all absolutely true, and then let that go toward shaping your feeling about things nuclear, I guess, and nuclear power. And I'm going to ask Professor Kaku about some sensitive stuff, as if we already haven't covered that, in a moment. The real beauty of talk radio, the real core of talk radio is the fact that a lot of times you'll do a talk show tonight as a perfect example and have all sorts of things lined up to talk about, and then because you get off on a certain tangent that just happens in an unrehearsed way, woof, down a road you go that you weren't even ready for. I love it. Here once again is Professor Kaku. Professor, I've interviewed you now many times, and I've come to my own conclusion, it's not very hard, that you are not, let's see, how can I best put this? You might even be an anti-nuclear activist at heart. Is that fair? Or, I mean, you had a chance to build the bomb, get in on building new and better and bigger bombs, and I know you turned it down. And you didn't go into that side of the work where you so easily could have. And I have a very strong sense that you're pretty anti-nuclear. Is that fair?
Well, let me explain. Okay. Edward Teller, who recently passed away, was the primary guiding influence when I was in high school and college. And I got to know the family quite well. And I got to know his politics and his thinking quite well. And as you mentioned, he even offered me a position to design hydrogen warheads.
Yes.
And his position was that nuclear power is potentially unstable. It does not belong on the surface of the Earth. It belongs underground. So he thought that because nuclear power plants were so unstable, because you could have supercriticality, meltdowns,
right,
bubbles, and Three Mile Islands,
right,
they should be placed underground. So if there was an explosion, you'd simply put a manhole cover on it and walk away from it.
Well, out of curiosity, Professor, why don't we do that?
Well, actually, believe it or not, Con Edison here in New York City, I'm in Manhattan right now, wanted to build a nuclear power plant in Queens, right opposite the United Nations, in the heart of New York City. And when the old Atomic Energy Commission said, over our dead body, will you build a nuclear power plant in the center of New York City, Con Edison reapplied, saying, we'll put it underground. We'll have an underground nuclear power plant in the center of New York City. It was to be called the Ravenswood Nuclear Power Plant, right opposite the United Nations. So all the delegates from around the world would throw open the blinds and see the gigantic cooling towers of a commercial nuclear power plant opposite the United Nations. Now, the point I'm raising is that even Teller, who, of course, unleashed the power of the hydrogen bomb,
yes,
who was certainly aware of the potential of nuclear energy, realized that, hey, you know, this is potentially unstable.
Yeah.
And an accident could really ruin commercial nuclear energy.
Mm.
And that's what his position was, that he was pro-nuclear, but that the only thing which could kill commercial nuclear power would be a horrible accident. And that's why he thought of them putting them underground.
Mm.
However, as you can suspect, the cost would be enormous. You would have to excavate the entire nuclear facility and to place it underground. It would be prohibitively expensive. But for me, it really impressed upon me the fact that even though we physicists uncorked the genie and released the genie out of the bottle, sometimes this genie is unstable. And sometimes, you know, we're too overconfident. We think we know the technology, and then, boom, it spirals out of control. And that really is a humbling experience, realizing that this technology is unfinished. It's an unfinished technology. The question is whether we should finish it or not. It could be very expensive to finish this technology. We still don't know what to do with nuclear waste. Yucca Mountains in your neck of the woods, where we have nuclear waste to be stored near Las Vegas.
Well, no woods here, but it's at my neck, all right.
Right.
Right
that's a big problem. What are we going to do with all this nuclear waste?
All right. I mean, is that a yes?
I would say that I'm critical of nuclear energy.
Yes, okay. Fair enough. You I believe, are of Oriental ancestry, are you not?
Mm-hmm.
Japanese, perhaps?
That's right.
Uh-huh. Kaku sounds Japanese. Does what happened, Professor, in Japan, what the United States did at the end of the war in Japan, does that in any way, do you think that your position on nuclear power is shaped by what happened in Japan?
I don't think so, in the sense that I went the other way. I thought that any technology that was that powerful, any technology that could flatten a city within a microsecond,
yes,
should have enormous benefits for the rest of the world. So when I was very young, I was quite enamored of nuclear technology. You know, I built an atom smasher when I was in high school. And I assembled 400 pounds of transformer steel. I wound 22 miles of copper wire on the football field. And I created a 2.3 million electron volt Betatron electron accelerator in my garage.
Didn't that disturb people?
Well, every time I plugged it in, I would blow out every circuit breaker in the house. And all the lights would dim. And my poor mother, you know, she probably said to herself, why couldn't I have a son who plays basketball? Maybe if I buy him a baseball, he'll find something suitable. And she once said, for God's sake, why can't he find a Japanese girl?
Yeah.
What's wrong with him, building these machines in the garage?
Was your mom first generation Japanese?
Well, she was actually, my father and mother were actually in the relocation camps, the concentration camps in California during World War II.
Okay, then I double my question down. I mean, a history like that, Professor, I didn't know that history of you, but I suspected a possibility.
Mm-hmm.
And when you really dig deep, There's got to be a part of you that all of that comes home to shape.
Well, my parents were, first of all, were citizens of the United States.
Yes, my
parents were born in California.
Yes, sir.
My grandfather was in the 1906 San Francisco earthquake. He was part of the cleanup operation in during the earthquake. And so, but, you know, even if you are citizens, you could be still arrested.
We apologize for those. And then we paid money. And do you know what? We didn't change the ability of a president to be able to do it again. Did you know that?
Yeah, they're still on the books.
Yeah, it's still on the books.
The McCarran Act.
That's right.
Still on the books. The Supreme Court has never touched that. It's a minefield. So
right.
It's still on the books, basically.
Exactly right. Something for people to know. It could be done again. And
it's kind of sobering. Within a matter of months, 100,000 people just shipped off to racetracks and then to these camps.
You bet. And all of that, somehow, Professor, all of that has got to shape you.
Yes. However, when I was young, like I said, I was very much pro-nuclear because this was the nuclear age. Atoms for Peace was what everyone was talking about. I personally wanted to go to the extreme in the sense of working on Einstein's unified field theory. I mean, that to me was the ultimate atomic physics. But I was, very much pro-nuclear in those days.
Mm-hmm.
But then I began, as a graduate student, I began to have doubts about this technology.
And what fed those? In other words, what began those doubts? Why?
Well, I began to hear about these incidents. I began to hear about the fatalities, even though we were told no one has ever died in a nuclear accident. And I was just a graduate student. I had heard that, bombs had essentially gone out of control. I had heard that workers had been blown up, seven of them. Had been blown up in supercriticality accidents. And then when I became a professor, I have access to files. I can get the files now. So I begin to realize there was this whole hidden history that nuclear power plants are quite unstable unless you are very, very careful. And it's an unforgiving technology.
Well,
one mistake and it blows up in your face.
Well, all right, suppose I made the argument, and I will because I'm devil's advocate every now and then, but look, here in Nevada, we built a great big dam. During the building of that dam, to create electricity for Southern California now and Southern Nevada, a lot of people died in the building of that dam. So accidents do happen. When you're dealing with the creation of large projects in energy, a certain amount of accidents do happen, period. I mean, people fell into that as a concrete tomb and died, and I forget how many died, but a substantial number. So what about factoring that in?
Well, the difference is that if a nuclear power plant spins out of control, you can lose an entire city. The government did a computer study of reactors like Indian Point, located about 20 miles north of where I'm sitting right now. And a big accident at Indian Points 2 and 3 would cause about $300 billion in property damage, would literally obliterate the entire New York area. And there are, 20 million people that live within 50 miles of that nuclear power plant. And it, in some sense, if you take a look at the cold accounting of the numbers, it is perhaps the most dangerous commercial machine on the planet Earth. And that was in $1980. In 2003 dollars, that would probably be in excess of $1 trillion property damage if those reactors ever went up in smoke. And if anyone today were to ask the government permission to site a nuclear power plant so close to New York City, they would say, you're out of your mind. There's no way we're going to site a nuclear power plant that close to a city. And yet, here we are. We have Zion very close to Chicago. We have Indian Point very close to New York City. And now we know, the public knows after Three Mile Island and Chernobyl that these reactors are potentially unstable. And yet, we were building these things so close to New York City. And like I said, in the early 60s, they wanted to put a nuclear power plant in the center of New York City, in Ravenswood, Queens.
All right. Right
next to Archie Bunker territory.
What do you think we ought to be doing? In other words, if you could reshape America, the world's policy, on the peaceful uses of nuclear power, how would you have it set up?
Well, I think we should, first of all, admit that the Atoms for Peace program let the cat out of the bag. I'm a physicist. There's no law of physics really separating commercial from weapons technology. It's the same technology. You just increase the enrichment level from 3% to 90%. That's it. That's the difference. The Indians discovered this. So that's why they detonated their first bomb in the 1970s using an experimental CANDU reactor. They took this Atoms for Peace program, which was never designed to make bombs, but the physics is the same. The Indians were not stupid. They surreptitiously refined the nuclear waste, and they detonated their first bomb in the 1970s.
That's true.
And now we have this technology proliferating all over the place. Take a look at North Korea. North Korea has uranium technology, which shocked us. We didn't think they had uranium technology. And where did they get it? The New York Times said they got it from Pakistan. Mm. Well, where did Pakistan get this uranium technology from? Essentially from Germany and the United States. We allowed that technology to flood into Pakistan during the Afghan War when Ronald Reagan was opposing the Soviet Union in Afghanistan. And he wanted $1 billion of aid to go to the Afghan rebels. Well, that's okay. But what happened was the Pakistanis wanted something in exchange.
So you're saying we are the proliferators?
Believe it or not.
Well,
believe it
I
or
do.
Not,
I do.
It's hard to believe. But when you really get your hands around it, the United States winked at Pakistan, and Pakistan winks at North Korea.
No, there was a day.
And then we're shocked when North Korea comes up with uranium enrichment technology.
There was a day when that would have shocked me, but I'm sorry, I'm way past that. You know, ever since the tests on pregnant women and the tests on the American public and radiation testing and all that was admitted to, it's hard to get shocked after all of that.
Mm-hmm, right. And so this Atoms for Peace program, I tell you, you know, a lot of countries are not stupid. They know there is almost no difference between weapons technology and commercial technology,
sure,
except the enrichment level, which, of course, affects the chemistry a bit.
Mm.
But it's basically the enrichment level that you want. And the Iranians, believe it or not, are absolutely correct in stating that all they want is commercially available technology from Russia. And President Clinton was the first American president to admit that commercial technology, which is legally available, can be used to make atomic bombs.
Sure.
And the Iranians were saying, no, wait a minute, we obey the letter of the law. You set the rules. You made the rules. The West made the rules. We follow the rules.
Yeah.
And, yeah, the Iranians apparently want to build an atomic bomb, and they're using commercial technology to do it. So I think we have to recognize the Atoms for Peace program was inherently flawed. In fact, just last week, the director of the United Nations International Atomic Energy Agency said so much. He said it's fundamentally flawed, that this old architecture of Atoms for Peace was a big mistake in some sense.
All right. Well, then cat's already out of the bag.
Yep.
What now?
Well, I think we're going to have to do some hard-nosed negotiation with the Iranians, with the North Koreans, to make sure that they don't proliferate their bomb-making capabilities. But I think we have to realize that smaller nations, and eventually terrorists, eventually small nation states that are working with terrorists, may get access to some of this technology. And that's really frightening. Take a look at Russia. You have weapons-grade fuel just lying on the floor sometimes in Russia.
I've heard that. Yeah.
No one really knows how much uranium-enriched fuel was processed in Russia, because the commissars used to always overproduce weapons-grade uranium and meet the quotas. And then, of course, during a rainy day, they can take this extra fuel out of the closet and make their quota, right?
Sure.
Well, no one knows how much uranium fuel is in the closet. There are no accountings for this because the commissars were very careful in, you know, squirreling away uranium fuel for a rainy day. Well, that rainy day never came. The Soviet Union broke apart, and who knows how much uranium enriched uranium the Russians really have. They themselves don't really know. And that's frightening. When I talked to some bomb scientists who went to Russia, and they told me that they were shaken when they realized that even the Russians don't know how much uranium fuel is floating around. So, you know, this is the price we paid for going into the peaceful atom.
You know, after a lecture like this, I'm tempted to ask you about your old scales. You remember type 0, type 1,
mm-hmm, right.
type 2, type 3?
That's right.
Right? I mean, it's a little depressing listening to what you just said, if you fully grasp it. And it would seem to me that if I were to ask you now, our chances of making it to, what is it, a full type 1?
Type 1.
Yeah, type 1. Our chances have got to be really bad.
Well, we are embarking, as I mentioned before on this show, the greatest transition in all of human history, the transition from type 0 to type 1. And it's taken, you know, us humans 100,000 years ever since modern humans emerged to reach the stage of being on the threshold of type 1. And we could blow it. We could easily blow it because of designer germs, because of designer nuclear weapons, and because of the designer chemicals.
Well, how optimistic are you, or pessimistic, really, cutting to the chase?
Well, you know, at the height of the Cold War, it was really frightening at the height of the Cold War. You have to put things into perspective. You know, there were war plans on both sides for a preemptive strike. United States, the archives of the National... Well, many of these war plans are now declassified.
Well, all right.
And if you look at them, they're very frightening. They're first strike war plans.
Let's actually talk about that. I'd like to talk about first strike when we get back. What a program. Professor Michio Kaku is my guest, and if it gets any better than this with talk radio, I certainly don't know how. From the high desert in the middle of the night, this is Coast to Coast AM. I'm Art Bell. Good morning.
With Art Bell, call the Wildcard line at area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll-free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5. And dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
Good evening, everybody. I am Art Bell. Well, actually, for George tonight. He'll be back tomorrow night. And Dr. Michio Kaku is my guest, and this is absolutely riveting stuff. First strike, huh? Do you believe in miracles? Well, we got through the Cold War without either side resorting to a first strike. That's almost a miracle, isn't it? It's clearly the unthinkable. It clearly is the unthinkable. But both sides apparently had first strike plans drawn up on the table during all those terrible years that I lived through. I got under my desk at school and put my hands over my back of my neck. I knew how to protect myself from an A-bomb, by God! Just kidding. But I did do that. They did have us do it. Do you remember that campaign, Professor?
That's right. And now that it's been so many decades after those horrible years, a lot of this information is being declassified, both from Russia and the United States.
What do we know?
And we know that we came awfully close. They were hotheads arguing for preemptive strike. We know that in 1948, as early as then, during the Berlin crisis, the Secretary of Defense, Forrestal, was arguing for a first strike to execute Operation Broiler. Operation Broiler was the plan for a preemptive nuclear first strike on Russia in 1948 with a fleet of old bombers dropping what is called a Mark III atomic bomb on Russia.
Well, would we have done? Would we have hit military targets, obviously, and beyond that, were there plans to hit civilian targets?
The plans list the cities. In fact, again, if you go to the National Archives, you can get these plans. In the 50s, the most elaborate plan was called Operation Off-Tackle. All the cities were listed, and it basically says that within 6 hours, the Soviet Union would cease to exist as a functioning nation. All the major cities would be obliterated. And in 1954, there were hotheads within the Joint Chiefs arguing for a preemptive strike. And, of course, during the Kennedy administration, people were shocked when they found out that at the height of the Cuban Missile Crisis, there were hotheads, again, arguing for a preemptive first strike.
I wonder how close to getting their ideas accepted they got.
Well, we know from the transcripts now that have been gradually leaked out of the Cuban Missile Crisis that Kennedy put his foot down and overruled some of the hotheads in his own administration who were saying that, you know, it's neither now or never. Finally, the moment of truth has come.
Uh-huh.
Eisenhower had to deal with the same thing in 1954. There was a subcommittee of the Joint Chiefs of Staff arguing for a preemptive first strike on Russia in 1954.
All right. Wouldn't all these plans, Professor, have the likelihood of the outcome? How many million would be dead? How long the geography would be unlivable? And then, of course, there would be a certain amount of retaliation, without question. They'd have launched against us or launched whatever they could have. Did these plans include the possibility of so much success that they literally wouldn't be able to launch back against us?
Well, and again, Russia probably also had similar plans. Who knows for sure?
I'm sure.
But the point you raise is that, yes, in 54, when Eisenhower was presented the option of initiating Operation Off-Tackle, they estimated that 735 bombers hitting the radar screens simultaneously on the Soviet Union's radar screens.
Right.
That in 6 hours they would have total victory. That the Russians may be able to get maybe one Bison or a few Bear bombers off the ground and cause some havoc maybe in Europe, but they wouldn't be able to hit the United States. But they argued that after 54, the Bison and Bear bombers would be able to hit the United States, and the window would close after 1954.
Were they right?
Well, what happened was Eisenhower, very interestingly enough, organized a study group called the Solarium to investigate whether or not this talk of the hotheads was correct or not.
Right.
And the conclusion was, believe it or not, there was no Star Wars in 1954.
Right.
There was no way to shoot down the Bison or Bear bomber.
Right.
As the report mentioned, even Cuban biplanes could reach Florida. So in other words, all these plans had assumed that the Russians could not retaliate. But after 54, they had the Bison and Bear, and they could hit the United States. And so that window was rapidly closing. And after 54, the window closed. It meant that we were now two scorpions in a bottle.
Mm-hmm.
You strike me, I strike you, and we both die in the bottle.
Yes.
But before 54, it was basically, you know, the United States option of nuclear first strike.
They were right.
After 54, the window closed.
I've got that. But prior to that, they were right. They could have, at that point, struck.
Well, that's what the hotheads in the Eisenhower administration were arguing. John Foster Dulles
that's
was
amazing.
Arguing that we should hit Red China during the Komoimatsu episode.
There would be many today who would say we should have.
Well, it would be chaos. Now we know that it would have set off nuclear winter, by the way. If you hit Russia with 735 bombers dropping an enormous amount of megatonnage, it would not only have sent nuclear fallout over the United States.
Oh, of course.
It would have blackened out the sun.
And for what period of time, with what consequences? Nuclear winter, I've been curious about it. What do you really mean? For how long? What effect on the planet? Would we, in the United States, after attacking Russia like that, living through a nuclear winter, would we survive?
Well, first of all, the dinosaurs were killed off perhaps in a matter of maybe 8 months to a year.
Right.
Because the comet or meteor hit the Yucatan of Mexico 65 million years ago, lofting several cubic miles of dirt into the air, blocking out sunlight.
Effectively a nuclear winter.
That's right. And, Carl Sagan had estimated that perhaps 100 megatons, very little, that's a tiny fraction of our arsenal, 100 megatons. In fact, we were thinking of dropping 100 megatons on Moscow alone. 100 megatons would be enough to destabilize the atmosphere. Now, the Pentagon did its own study to rebut Carl Sagan, in all fairness. They stated that you would not have a total nuclear winter, you would have nuclear autumn, said the Pentagon. In other words, crops would fail, mass famine, many, many millions of people would die, but humanity would survive.
Just with 100 megatons.
100 megatons, which is like the tip of your finger in terms of the total arsenal.
Sure.
We had 30,000 atomic and hydrogen bombs at the height of the Cold War, and the Russians did too. That's 60,000 nuclear weapons.
And we've been reducing ours at what sort of rate? What percentage do we have left of what we had at the height?
The strategic bombs have been regulated by arms agreements. And so we're now down to about 5,000 range. So it's come down.
From 30,000 at the height to 5,000 now.
But that's strategic. We also have small tactical bombs.
May I ask a tough question?
Yeah. Go ahead.
There's going to be a level of criticality as we continue to reduce the number of weapons on each side. At what point, Professor, does it become, in the minds of somebody out there, survivable? In other words, aren't we better having large numbers that would mean suicidal, catastrophic end for all? Isn't it almost better that way than reducing the number to the point where somebody might consider it now something that could be done that would be something less than suicidal?
Well, in the movie Dr. Strangelove, you remember that there was a doomsday machine that would, if the United States struck, then Russia would destroy the entire human race.
Oh, how I remember, yes.
Well, that doomsday machine does exist. It is winter. It is nuclear winter in the sense that anyone that strikes first with a strategic arsenal would set off nuclear winter, which, again, would plunge humanity to the brink of the Stone Age. Famine would break out, food riots, hundreds of millions would die.
Worldwide.
It would be worldwide.
Worldwide.
And so any nation that, either Russia or the United States, that entertains this possibility would plunge the world into nuclear winter.
Well, all right, let's use the government's calculation of nuclear fall, you said. Well, even if their estimation is true, then how many more megatons to get from fall to winter?
Oh, yeah. Well, again, these people were estimating 100 megatons, and our arsenal is measured in the thousands. You realize that a typical bomb is 1 megaton, a typical bomb.
Right.
And we had 30,000 tactical and strategic nuclear weapons. So we had not just 100 megatons, but thousands of megatons to spare. And so in case of a full-scale war, then all computer programs would say that, yeah, you're talking about something like would kill the dinosaurs. And so you're talking about something that could inflict not just growing areas and farmland, but the entire population of the Earth. So the human race itself could face extinction if a sizable fraction of these weapons were set off.
Huh.
So it's very sobering. So I think the alternative is to negotiate and bring down these numbers. Right now we're in the thousands. And
I guess what I was asking, though, Professor, is wouldn't there be a level of danger when it got too low? Do you follow me?
Well,
if it's sound psychology that it's suicidal and that's why it hasn't happened yet, then bringing it to the point where it might be slightly less than suicidal wouldn't be bright necessarily, would it?
Well, Robert McNamara, the late Secretary of Defense, advocated something called minimal deterrence. That is maybe like 100 warheads. So each side would have 100 warheads, sufficient to perhaps destroy the Earth via nuclear winter. And that would then bring us down to you know, a fairly low level of nuclear bombs, but sufficient, again, to cause havoc with the atmosphere and havoc on the planet Earth.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that, of course, lets the cat out of the bag. These weapons are for political purposes. They're to threaten people.
Yes.
They're to control conventional crises.
Yes.
So like a poker game, a nuclear winter, I mean, the first strike is a royal flush, but it's part of a continuum. So I think we have to realize that the military does not see any big difference between conventional and nuclear. Nuclear is just the royal flush, that's all to them. And politicians view this as a weapon of coercion. Now, the average American doesn't think that way. The average American just says, well, they hit us, we hit them back, period. That's it. End of story. We're John Wayne. We never get angry. We always fire second. They don't realize that nuclear weapons, in some sense, are used every day to threaten, to like a poker game, basically, to threaten an enemy with a royal flush and to create uncertainty in the minds of an adversary. That's why at the beginning of the Gulf War, for example, the first Gulf War back in 91, Newsweek magazine had a big spread laying out the nuclear option, interviewing senior military officials of the first Bush administration, laying out the nuclear option on Iraq.
Can I post a question to you, please?
Yeah.
Let me put you in a position for a moment of being advisor to the president.
Mm-hmm.
And suppose the president received information that Russia was secretly planning a first strike against us. No doubt about it, it was going to happen. Would you counsel a president to, under that, in that situation, initiate a first strike yourself before the Russians hit us, knowing full well they absolutely were going to hit us? Or would you say, no, Mr. President, something's got to be left to the human race, don't do it?
Well, I would say that whoever said there's 100% certainty that the Russians are planning a first strike is probably out of his mind.
Well,
because Russia is in a very sad state, economically speaking. Their economy is in free fall.
Absolutely.
And they can barely keep the arsenal they have intact. They cannot keep bomb scientists in Russia.
But still,
I was in Russia several years ago, and some bomb scientists came up to me and asked me whether or not I could offer them a job. I could have hired right on the spot several top Russian bomb scientists. That's how bad it was.
I know it's awful. I've been there myself. It is really awful, no question about it.
Mm-hmm.
But still,
so I would counsel the president that whoever said it's 100% certainty that Russia is preparing a first strike is out of his mind.
Out of his mind.
Yeah.
You don't think there could, well, I mean, but there could have been, as they spiraled down economically, there was that use it or lose it minute for them, or so. Had to be, right?
Well, yeah, there is a use it or lose it, use it or lose it psychology among weaponeers.
Yes, sir.
If you wait too long, then they hit you with a first strike, and
yes,
you have nothing left for a second strike.
Exactly.
So this is called, you know, counterforce calculus, the calculus of nuclear warfare. But, what was the question now?
The question was, if you couldn't give that answer, in other words, if there was solid, absolute intelligence that you were going to get hit first, could you and would you counsel our own first strike? Just if you had to push yourself into that scenario and couldn't give that answer, I mean, it was obvious they were about to strike us. Would you counsel to strike them first, or is your morality and ethics and thinking go well beyond our borders and just around the world? So you'd answer for the world, not for the U.S.
Well, what I would do is, again, we're talking, I guess, in the 50s, because now, of course, it's credible.
Sure.
In the 50s, it was credible.
Yes, sir. Okay.
People did look at the scenario very carefully.
It's okay. So
I would get on the hotline.
Yeah.
I would get on the hotline and say that if you launch your first strike, it's the end of humanity. Whether or not I strike second is irrelevant. The atmosphere will be destabilized. There'll be mass famine throughout the Earth. Humanity will be flung thousands of years into the past.
Yes.
And we'll fight World War IV with rocks.
Yes.
As Einstein used to say.
So
I would get on the hotline and tell my counterpart, or recommend that the president talk to his counterpart, and say that this is madness because he's not going to benefit. Every ruler wants to work in his benefit for his country, and it's not in the benefit of an adversary's country to go back to the Stone Age. But that's what we're talking about.
So apparently both sides did obviously realize that.
It came very close. I tell you, man, on certain occasions in the 50s, it came very close with people like Curtis LeMay later telling people publicly, yes, it came extremely close with people like him arguing for a first strike.
Huh. Well, I know from today's perspective, it's very easy to look back and, you know, I guess vision, you know, it's 2020 and all that when looking in reverse, but at the time, I mean, there were rational arguments, perhaps, that, or they would have sounded rational.
That's right. That's why in 54, the recommendation was made for a preemptive first strike through a subcommittee of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, because they said explicitly, you wait any longer, and it's too late. The Russians will have operational counterforce capability with the Bison and Bear.
That's a damn powerful argument, and it would take quite a leader to say no.
And it took Eisenhower. Eisenhower looked at the results of Solarium, and he canceled. He canceled all these recommendations from the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And I think it was the wisdom of Eisenhower, believe it or not, who quietly shelved these plans. There was no Star Wars. There was no way to shoot down the Bison and Bear bomber.
So
of course, some people still want to create Star Wars so they can shoot down the...
In the end, the only thing that kept us from nuclear war was self-interest. That's it.
Self-interest. I think Eisenhower realized that the window had closed, had just closed in 54 with the operational Bison and Bear bombers of the Russians that could hit Washington, D.C. with a few atomic bombs.
Oh, my goodness.
That's how close it came. Luckily, we made it, but by the skin of our teeth, I think.
Another really hard question for you, Professor, would be, if you were in a position to give the other side, the little bit of help they need to help close that door and prevent what otherwise would happen, would you do such a thing in the interest of the world? Otherwise called spying, I suppose, but...
Well, I think it's in the interest of everybody to wind down the crisis rather than accelerate and proliferate.
You bet. You
technology.
Bet. You bet.
Wind it down rather than accelerate it.
Professor, hold tight.
Take a ride? To talk with Art Bell, call the wildcard line at area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll-free 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
It is indeed, and this one is really out of control. This is quite a program, no question about it, red hot. Dr. Michio Kaku is my guest. A lot of unplanned dialogue, but absolutely fascinating this morning. More of it coming along in a moment. You know, I've been so fascinated with all of this that I haven't done what's fair, and somebody gives us something like we're getting tonight. He's written some books. He sure does deserve an opportunity to plug the heck out of them. Professor, your books, and they're generally available, and after people have heard you like this, they're definitely going to want your books. So which ones would you recommend?
Well, the book that is a primer on the unified field theory and all this excitement that is generated is Hyperspace. It was a bestseller, and I highly recommend that. There's another book called Beyond Einstein, which also talks about particle physics and the quantum theory and also string theory.
Mm-hmm.
Then for those people interested in the future, there's a book I wrote called Visions.
Assuming we have one.
Right, and on my website, you can see descriptions of all these books, mkaku.org, mkaku.org.
Right.
And we have over 30 million hits on that website.
I bet you do.
And, thanks to you, of course. And I have two books coming out next year. In April, I have a modern biography of Albert Einstein, In Time for the Centennial. The Centennial of Relativity is 2005. 100 years of E equals MC squared.
You've really been busy.
That's right. So in April, a modern biography of Einstein called Einstein's Cosmos, totally reevaluating the legacy of the man. And, of course, the 2005 is the 100th year anniversary.
Can you lay a couple of highlights of that on us? I mean, a modern biography of Einstein. What is it we know today? What outstanding facts about Einstein do we know today that rewrite what we thought we knew?
Well, if you read all the biographies of the man, all of them say that after 1925, he was over the hill, no more ideas, and that he spent all his time working for peace. But scientifically, he was washed up by 1925.
Not so, huh?
Not so. If you take a look at modern history today with satellites, we now have satellites that can prove all the conjectures that Einstein made in the 1930s and 40s that could not be verified without satellites. Gravity wave detectors, for example, from colliding black holes. Black holes themselves have now been detected with the Hubble Space Telescope and
That's
the Chandra
right.
X-ray Telescope. Not to mention Einstein rings, that is, the distortion of distant starlight so that light from a distant galaxy looks like a ring rather than like a dot. Not to mention the fact that Nobel Prizes have been given for scientists who've investigated crumbs, the crumbs off Einstein's table, like Bose-Einstein condensates, won several Nobel Prizes for individuals, all of which was predicted by Albert Einstein. And, of course, he spent the later decades of his life searching for the unified field theory. And that, of course, is now the dominant theme within my field, theoretical physics. It's a gold rush. If you're young and ambitious, you want to crack the unified field theory. There's a bunch of Nobel Prizes waiting for young people who can crack the biggest problem of all time.
I'm curious about something with regard to Einstein.
Mm-hmm.
Don't you suppose, Professor, there was a moment when Einstein said to himself, before he let anybody know about anything, he's, you know, that, look, I understand in my own mind that what I am about to do is the equivalent of handing a four-year-old child a cherry bomb and a lit match.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Do you suppose, and with his intellect, he still handed us the cherry bomb and the match. I mean, he really did, and there had to be that moment for him.
Well, it happened in stages. First of all, he knew it was a cherry bomb, but he did not have the match. And originally, he thought the match was impossible. And in the 1920s, journalists would always ask him about E equals MC squared and whether a bomb could be made.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, as you point out, yeah, it is a cherry bomb. It's there, but there's no match, you see. And what shocked him was that the match was finally created in the late 30s with a chain reaction. Einstein never thought that there could be a chain reaction that could then set off. He made one reference to a chain reaction, by the way.
So then he didn't really fully understand the implications of his early work at that moment.
Well, he knew that a bomb could be made if you could have this match. And he toyed with the idea of a chain reaction. There's one quote where he actually says that perhaps there's some way to magnify the minute energy contained within a nucleus. But he didn't know the steps by which to do this. Mm-hmm. And that, of course, was done by Otto Hahn, Liz Meitler in the late 1930s, giving us the possibility of critical mass. So with Einstein, he knew that there was potential to release enormous amounts of energy. He suspected that the stars got their energy this way. So it was possible to unleash this energy. Just look at the sun, right? Just look at the galaxy.
Sure.
So he knew that nature unleashes this technology. He didn't think that on Earth you could unleash the power of the sun. Now we know, of course, that an atomic bomb is nothing but a piece of the sun placed on the Earth. But so Einstein suspected that this was a secret of the stars. But he had no way of lighting the match.
Yeah.
Now we know how to light the match.
Right.
And that's caused all this problem.
So he couldn't see that far ahead, simply
yeah.
put. All right. Michael from Kansas City has a really good question. Since we've been on this bomb topic, this is a really good one. Whatever happened to the neutron bomb? Now, the neutron bomb would have changed everything, or shouldn't it have? Or do we have neutron bombs? Do we still have them? They killed without blowing stuff up, right?
People call them the landlord's bomb
because it's a great
way to clever way to evict the tenants without damaging your building.
How effective would that bomb, or is that bomb? I mean, could you destroy an entire, just kill everything in a city without touching, blowing anything up?
Okay, let's talk about bombs through generations. The first generation atomic bombs were huge, gigantic devices that were so big they could barely fit in the bomb bay of a B-52 bomber. Those are first generation bombs.
Yes.
Second generation bombs are small MIRVs. You could put 10 of them in the nose cone of an MX missile.
Right.
These are called second generation bombs. Small bombs. They're about 3 feet tall, 2.5 feet tall.
Huh.
Third generation bombs are designer bombs. And they are now slowly being devised and talked about. In fact, the Bush administration wants to allocate money now for the third generation. Third generation bombs are designer bombs. They are specifically designed for various purposes, to be used in the desert, to be used underground, to be used in outer space, to be used in the jungle. Different designs of bombs for different purposes. These are called third generation.
Uh-huh.
The neutron bomb is a 2.5 generation bomb. It's between the second and third generation. It's often called a 2.5 generation bomb.
All right.
And as I mentioned, in 1991, get a copy of Newsweek magazine in January or February of that year, just before the outbreak of hostilities. Newsweek magazine interviewed several senior Pentagon officials, and they laid out the option. The neutron bomb was an option. First, they would hit Baghdad with the electromagnetic pulse. A bomb would be detonated over Baghdad. The pulse, the shock wave from the bomb would wipe out all the electronics, wiping out their surface-to-air missile defense system.
You're not talking about, or are you talking about, actually, a very large bomb detonated very high, or...
That's right. A conventional hydrogen bomb detonated over Baghdad, which would cause a shock wave.
How far over Baghdad?
Oh, you would have to do it several miles above the city, or else it would create, you know, heat and devastation. But the
yes.
shock wave... the United States did this back in the 1960s. They sent a Thor missile up into space and detonated a hydrogen bomb in space. And much to our shock, it created a shock wave which wiped out communications to some degree between San Francisco and Tokyo. It set off burglar alarms all over Hawaii. And then we realized a new phenomenon had been discovered, the electromagnetic pulse. We had never seen that before. And so the military had suddenly realized that in case of a real war, if they had detonated that bomb, we would have wiped out our own satellites.
Yes.
We would have blinded ourselves with the electromagnetic pulse. So anyway, the Newsweek magazine article lays out that first you'd hit Baghdad with a electromagnetic pulse weapon.
Right.
Then you would hit conventional troop emplacements with the neutron bomb. The neutron bomb would then be used against conventional troop emplacements.
I'm trying to get a sense of the scope of a neutron bomb. How wide an area could it virtually sterilize?
It's a small atomic bomb, about a kiloton's worth. while the Hiroshima bomb was maybe 10 times that, 10, yes. 15 times bigger than that. So it's a sub-Hiroshima type bomb that does emit heat, does emit blast, but it's minimal compared to what a Hiroshima bomb emits.
How big a blast?
Oh, it'd be quite devastating. If you hit it in a modern city, you do a considerable damage to the downtown area. Not much more, but you'd knock out a large portion of the downtown area.
And then beyond that, the radiation effects?
Much less, because most of the radiation is in neutrons. So this would be used against troop emplacements.
Huh.
If you have a concentrated number of troops, you hit them with a neutron bomb, and that's a kiloton of power. Realize that in the Iraqi war that many people saw on their TV screens,
yes.
We were talking about a 1,000-pound bomb or 2,000-pound bomb. Okay, and now we're talking about kilotons of TNT.
Actually, they were
several orders of magnitude.
They were talking about tens of thousands of pounds, I believe, are equivalent to in TNT, really a crazy giant figure. The Moab mother of all bombs or something. It was,
yeah, the mother of all bombs is,
impressive.
Again, in the ton range.
Right.
However, a nuclear weapon would be in the kiloton, 1,000-ton range. We're
yes.
talking about 1,000 times more than the mother of all bombs. So the neutron bomb packs a much bigger wallop than the mother of all bombs.
Somehow I always had it in my head that the neutron bomb virtually didn't even go boom. It just did this incredible radiation thing.
No. It's basically a stripped-on hydrogen bomb. A hydrogen bomb has three layers. A fission layer in the center, and then we're talking about an extra lithium deuteride surrounding that. And then surrounding that is another layer of uranium.
Well, then this breaks a giant myth, because the myth always was the neutron bomb was a totally clean thing to do and all.
Well, it's quite messy.
Quite messy.
It has blast, has heat, has everything. It has all the bad stuff of a regular bomb, except a lot of the radiation is in neutron form. So instead of a three-layer bomb, it's a two-layer bomb. You strip off the last uranium layer of a hydrogen bomb, and you get a neutron bomb. Basically.
Wonderful.
So a neutron bomb is a stripped-down hydrogen bomb. So it does create blasts. It does create lots of problems. And the Europeans hated it because it was to be used on their cities. It was to be used on troop emplacement in your cities. And so the Europeans realized there'd be nothing left of Europe if the neutron bomb was set off. So the neutron bomb still exists, and hopefully it'll never be used in warfare. But it is a two-and-a-half-generation bomb, because the third-generation bombs are earth penetrators, and they're designed to detonate underground. And, you know, like I said, the Bush administration has already placed it in the budget.
That is to kill underground bunkers, that kind of thing.
Yeah, to collapse, basically to bury people that are underground in bunkers.
Yes.
The North Koreans, of course, are deathly afraid of that, because most of their leadership is placed underground.
That's right.
And so I think that's probably one reason why the Bush administration is
developing
for these things specifically to threaten the leadership of North Korea, which is basically underground. So these are third-generation bombs, designer bombs, to be used in outer space as Star Wars, to be used on the ground as neutron bombs, and to be used underground as nuclear earth penetrators. And bunker busters.
There are those, Professor, who say that President Reagan's threat of Star Wars brought down communism, or, you know, that's unfair, I guess, was at least a fairly large factor in the final collapse. Do you buy into that?
Well, Ronald Reagan was once interviewed by a journalist who asked him a question. You know, spending Russia into a depression, that's always been the right-wing strategy, spending Russia into a depression. We build a bomb, they build a bomb.
Yes.
Well, the journalist asked, won't this backfire on the United States? Won't we be plunged into depression? And, you know, the president thought for a while, and then he said, maybe, but they'll bust first.
Wow.
Well, they bust first. And we could very well bust second. So it was very clear, I think, you know, from Reagan's own quote, that he knew it was a game of chicken,
mm-hmm.
that they were going to be spending themselves into a depression. We're spending ourselves into a depression. And who wins is the one who busts second. So Russia bust first. Their commissars mistakenly thought that security meant building more bombs, which meant less potatoes on people's dinner plate.
Well, here's what I always wondered about, Professor. Russia really, because it was kind of a failed economic plan, they could only continue to thrive by continuing to eat up territory, take more territory. If you've got a system that's not producing a profit, you've got to keep, that's the only way you can do it is take more territory. And it got to the point, I guess, where they couldn't do that without a suicidal act. But still, there must have been that moment of horrid consideration on the part of the communists when they realized their system couldn't expand at all because of the threat that they faced of extinction. So they couldn't do that. But then again, they had all these weapons. And if ever there was going to be a time to use them, a dark, psychologically disturbed moment when they would make the decision to use them, that would have come somewhere in there just before they went belly up economically and said, we quit.
Well, I think that the problem is the opposite. The problem with the Soviet Union was stagnation. Capitalism is quite vibrant. In fact, so vibrant that, you know, it does cause inequities.
Yes.
But the Soviet system creates the opposite, stability. Stability is a point of stagnation.
Yes.
So it's not the expansion, it's the stagnation that was always the worry. And in order to get out of that stagnation, you had to have technology, new ideas, and, you know, entrepreneurial spirit, as Ronald Reagan would say.
Yes.
And they lacked that. In fact, it got worse because they built so many bombs to catch up to the United States. You know, their economy was about a third of the U.S. economy, and they were trying to match our weapons.
Sure.
And that was the right-wing strategy, to lure the Russians to take potato off the dinner tables and to build weapons like the SS-18, the SS-20, to match the MX.
Well, that's why I kind of asked you, do you think Star Wars was the final trumping hand and the straw that broke the communists' back?
No, I don't think so. I think,
or at least part of it.
Well, I think what did them in was their own short-sightedness into thinking that security meant building more bombs. You know, the United States always led in building bombs. Every bomb was initiated first by the United States, first, second, third generation, all three generations.
Sure.
First initiated by the United States.
Yes.
The Russians should have said, okay, we stop. We have enough bombs to kill everybody, so we should stop and then put more potato on people's dinner table. But they didn't. They just kept building SS-18s, SS-20s, to match the MX and to match the Minuteman III, and it destabilized their system. So I think they'd done themselves in. It was self-inflicted to a certain degree.
Still, coming at the appropriate moment, Star Wars must have caused a lot of generals in Russia to throw up their hands, and you know, along with the politicians who knew they couldn't afford any more, and there was that moment there.
The Russian generals themselves said that their response to a Star Wars will be to simply pierce it. In other words, overwhelm it.
Yes.
Let's say 50% of your weapons will get past a Star Wars shield.
And that argument was made strongly here as well.
Yeah, it's very cheap. You know, you put tinfoil in your nose cone, and that tinfoil, you know, fools the enemy's radar. You know, that was done during World War II with jet planes releasing tinfoil to fool radar. You could do that in the nuclear age. And, you know, how cheap is tinfoil? How cheap are Mylar balloons to confuse radar? Pennies.
Yes.
Pennies to overwhelm a multi-billion-dollar radar system. And so the Russians said explicitly that you build Star Wars and we'll put more decoys in our warheads, more chaff, more tinfoil, which cost pennies, and we'll pierce the Star Wars shield. So I think what did them in was they tried to compete with the United States militarily, which was, I think, a big mistake. It bankrupted them.
Yes, it did. Anyway, it happened. At least it happened. All right, Professor, hold on. We're at the bottom of the hour. When we get back, we'll try and switch gears because this freight train's been really running in the bomb direction. Stuff I've never heard before. Absolutely fascinating stuff. In the nighttime, this is Coast.
Day after day, this is my night. to me. Oh, I
talk with Art Bell. Call the Wildcard line at area code 775-727-1295. The first time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call Art at 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art Bell by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
This entire program this morning could be a primer for those who didn't know a lot of things, didn't know what could have happened, almost happened, and in a lot of cases this morning, did happen. Here's a question out of left field for Dr. Kaku, just changing directions slightly, concerning the time travel paradox of returning to the past and killing one's grandfather.
Mm-hmm.
People like yourself, Doctor, currently, I guess, believe the solution would be the creation of multiple universes. I would respectfully suggest that this violates the law of parsimony. It is not the simplest solution to the problem. Instead, creation of an entire universe, creation of an entire new universe is a inefficient solution. I'm reading an email here. Has no one ever suggested a different perspective? What if each person instead carries with him or her their own, in essence, model universe? Personal relationships would be interactions and changes in point of contact of each person's model universe. In this solution, there'd be one universe for each sentient being, which would interact and change the universes of other sentient beings, other realities, such as mountains, oceans, planets, and stars, would be jointly shared by each person's model universe. In this solution, the crime, murder of the grandfather, would instantly cause DNA changes in the murdering grandson and his father, possibly several other offspring of the grandfather. This problem could get pretty messy, but it would respectfully suggest it's a far better solution, this emailer thinks, than creating a whole new universe out of nothing.
Okay, there are two major solutions to what happens when you kill your parents before you're born.
Right.
The other approach is advocated by physicist Igor Novikov. The Russian school believes that there's something called causality protection. Something prevents you from pulling the trigger as you point the gun to your parents before you're born. Now,
it just couldn't happen, is what
he's
saying.
That's right. He's saying that there's some kind of law of physics which he cannot elucidate in detail.
Mm.
He also says that you cannot walk on the ceiling. You may want to walk on the ceiling. Free will says, I want to walk on the ceiling. But there's a law, a physical law that prevents you from walking on the ceiling called the law of gravity. So he would like to postulate that, yes, there must be a physical law of some sort preventing you from pulling the trigger of the gun pointed at your parents before you're born.
Mm-hmm.
And he doesn't know quite what this thing is. He just calls it causality protection hypothesis. However, I tend to think that perhaps that interpretation is wrong, because even inanimate matter, you know, forget sentient beings, inanimate matter can also create paradoxes. Let's say I get a machine gun, and I simply sent it back into the past and give it to Alexander the Great's
enemies. That's a very good point. Yes.
And, you know, just inanimate matter going back into the past, given to Darius the Great, the Persian.
That's a very good point.
Would allow him to destroy Alexander the Great's troops, in which case we'd all be speaking a Persian right now rather than a European language. So even inanimate matter, forget sentient beings, even inanimate matter can create time travel paradoxes. So that's why I believe that even though some people think the many worlds interpretation has too much excess baggage. It is one of the dominant interpretations of the quantum theory.
All right.
So many Nobel laureates, Steve Weinberg, Murray Gell-Mann, these are giants in physics, Nobel laureates, who say that, yeah, some version of many worlds theory is probably what is really happening. And we just live in one branch of this much larger tree. And it does mean that there's another universe where Elvis is still alive. There's another universe where, you know, aliens are walking the street.
When do you think, Professor, that we might, what is the right word I guess I'm searching for, verify the existence of one of these alternate universes, actually manage to, in some manner, perhaps even interact with it, communicate, watch it, monitor it, do something with it, anything at all? I mean, is that in our future?
Well, that's the subject of my next book after Einstein Cosmos comes out. That book is called Parallel Worlds. It's going through final editing right now, and it'll come out perhaps a full year from now.
Incredible.
And in Parallel Worlds, I ask that very question. If there is a multiverse, and all the data points to a multiverse now, the WMAP satellite came out in February with the precise age of the universe. The universe is 13.7 billion years old, plus or minus 1%. And the leading theory that fits that data is something called inflation. And inflation, in turn, is based upon a multiverse of universes, bubbles forming constantly, so that our universes coexist with other bubbles. And even as we speak, big bangs have been taking place. And then the question is, what about leaving our bubble? The WMAP satellite in February released data that indicates that we're all going to freeze to death trillions of years from now.
Yes.
And it is kind of depressing, but sooner or later, everything runs down.
Not nearly so depressing as the first, couple and a half hours of the show we've just done. Actually, that says to me, don't worry about freezing to death because you're not going to make it. I mean, I'm a brutal odds guy, and as I listen to you, the chance of us getting through this proliferation without it all coming down around our heads, it's pretty slim.
Yeah, but I think the way to deal with all these depressing facts is action. You know, I mean, Einstein, many of the great giants of the age, Niels Bohr, others, said we must translate our knowledge into action. So they circulated petitions.
They're trying to do that on the other side, too, you know, translate
right.
Their ideas into.
That's right. So, again, you know, history belongs to those people who can seize the initiative. And I think it's a good thing that all the citizens of this country get activated to participate in the electoral process, to get energized. And, you know, make your statement felt at the voting booth.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, we should have an agenda that does put forth a future where we have a future.
By the way, speaking of agendas and something a little more cheerful, you know, we were going to have a program tonight where we were going to talk about the future of outer space, for example. The president is about to make a big speech. All rumor is that he's going to announce the U.S. going back into space, you know, going to the moon or maybe even a base on the moon for going to Mars and all kinds of stuff that he might say.
Mm-hmm.
Anniversary of the Wright brothers. And so I did want to get a word or two from you on how you feel about all this.
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, I think we should have a permanent moon base. However, I think it should be robotic. We left the moon, we went there, scored a touchdown, came back with our football, and just left the moon there. I think we should have a permanent presence on the moon.
Why robotic?
Because it'd be cheap, wouldn't be dangerous. We would have be able to, you know, do 10 times more things because they're 10 times cheaper. They don't have to come back. They don't require life support. And we should have these things on the moon. If you saw the movie 2001, of course, the whole movie is prefaced on the idea that there are uncharted areas of the moon, you know, talking about previous visitations from aliens.
Absolutely.
And like I said, I believe that if aliens have ever gone past our solar system, the most likely place for them to have a base or had a base is the moon.
Would you think there's a fair chance we actually might uncover some sort of robotic obelisk if we dig around enough on the moon?
I can't rule it out. It is the most mathematically efficient way to explore the solar system. Forget Captain Kirk. these self-replicating von Neumann probes on the moon
yes.
would be the ideal place to colonize and investigate the galaxy because, you know, Enterprises and Captain Kirk's are very expensive and there are very few of them. But self-replicating robotic probes self-replicate. They live off the land. You don't have to do anything. They simply replicate and explore other moons. And our moon is ideal because it circles a planet that has liquid water. Liquid water is a universal solvent. And any alien that came through our solar system millions, billions of years ago would have picked out our Earth as the possible mother of life in the future. And they would have left the probe on the moon waiting for us.
Let me ask you a question about that probe. Let's say we find one, Professor. All right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, I take you back years to a moment where we actually transmitted from Arecibo, using the wonderful giant dish at Arecibo, we transmitted a very short transmission to go scorching out in way past everything to whatever life might be out there. We did fire one transmission in one direction, and after that, Professor, they said, you're not doing it anymore. And the reason you're not going to do it anymore, and they were serious about this, is we don't know what the consequences would be of our message getting received. And maybe, you know, somebody will receive it, and maybe we won't be so happy about the fact that they did. In other words, they might not be friendly.
That's so, right. They may look at us and say, lunch. Right?
Or whatever, yes. And so now we've got an obelisk on the moon. If we, would you recommend going ahead, for example, and uncovering that obelisk, giving it an opportunity, as it did in 2001, to make a transmission that suddenly alarms our presence, or would you advise against it? What a moment of choice that one would be.
Well, first of all, the object's probably been there for millions of years.
Yes.
And, in other words, it's been sending reports all along.
Yes.
About the status of carbon-based life forms on a planet that has liquid water.
So you're figuring they're watching already?
They're probably watching already. And they're probably a great distance away, so they're not going to be able to come visit us anytime soon. However, it does mean that we have to realize that we're probably not alone in the universe, that the moon is the most likely place for a visitation.
Sure.
And that if we go back to the moon, I think that should be in the back of the mind of anyone who wants to set up a permanent moon base there.
Right. Let's say there, it is. And let's say you discover the obelisk, Professor.
Yeah, there are huge parts of the moon that are totally unexplored.
Would you recommend digging it up and activating it? In other words, what kind of calculation as a physicist, scientist, would you make about the nature of the people we would eventually meet as a result of what we were about to do?
Well, in the movie, an astronaut touches the obelisk and it sends a message to the home planet.
That's right.
That, you know, like a screaming message, right?
That's right.
I would suspect that we should first just analyze it to see what kinds of technologies are involved. For example, nanotechnology is probably not very big, in which case they've probably been able to harness nanotechnology millions of years ago. And that's why these things could be quite small and is probably capable of self-replication. And so it's probably quite sophisticated, and the moon is very stable. It's been stable for, 3-4 billion years.
Mm-hmm.
So an obelisk like this would be stable for an extended period of time. And it's probably already been sending messages. So, but, you know, we don't want to activate it unnecessarily because we don't know their intentions.
There you are. I was wondering if you would recommend extreme caution in that regard.
I'll recommend extreme caution, yes.
And what kind of debates would there be about the merit of activation?
No, we send radio and television to outer space. You know, we send Beavis and Butthead into outer space. And any intelligent being that picks up Beavis and Butthead would wonder whether there's any intelligent life worth contacting.
You and I are on the way out there right now.
Right. And so I think, however, that any intelligent being realizing that a planet with liquid water would be an ideal arena to create autocatalytic molecules called DNA, would be quite curious and have, you know, regular reports. So this obelisk has been sending reports.
Yes.
So I don't think we have to fear it. They would have been here causing havoc years before it hit.
So then scientifically you would conclude that if they wanted to dispose of us in some unsavory manner, that would have already occurred.
That's right. And, however, that's why I think that a permanent moon base would actually be a good idea. Not only would we know more about the origin of the moon, the solar system, solar storms, and we had a huge solar storm just last month, you know.
Oh, it was incredible.
It wiped out two satellites.
Incredible. Yes. By the way, yes, we've only got a few moments, but a comment on the recent spate of outrageous solar activity. I mean, you know, in a part of the cycle where there's no way this should be happening. I'm not saying it can't happen, but almost no way we should be getting super flares.
Yeah, this is the biggest in 150 years.
Yeah.
You have to go back to 1850-something or other. That storm was so big, by the way, that telegraph lines activated all by themselves without any electricity. It actually induced electricity to send telegraph signals.
Right.
That's how powerful it was back then.
Right.
So the storm luckily missed us. The sunspot was pointing the wrong direction. As the sun spins, this one sunspot was ejecting all this the solar flares and radiation into the atmosphere, into outer space. Luckily, it was pointed the wrong way, and so we missed the bullet. If that bullet had hit,
yes,
it could have destroyed a good fraction of the satellites. Your TV screen would have been wiped out. Your radio transmission, the internet, probably all would have gone.
God, blue. The end of civilization as we know.
And power lines would have been had power surges in power lines. It would have been very messy had that solar flare hit us. And it just goes to show you that we don't know that much about the sun. Sunspot cycles are 11 years, of course, but we're in the middle of the sunspot cycle. We were not due for another.
I'm so fascinated, Professor, that I sit with the one-minute X-ray chart. During that time, I just sat with the one-minute X-ray chart up on my screen, and there were a couple of times I went right through the roof. I mean, as the vertical line would start and go shooting up past the high X category, mm-hmm. I started going, oh, my God. This is really, really, really serious. And I was talking to a bunch of people, friends on ham radio about it, and it was quite a time, and it may not be over. Any guesses, Professor, what's going on with our sun?
Well, this caught a lot of people by surprise.
Mm.
We categorize these by the letter X, and so we give them numbers, and this was almost off scale. And if you take a look at the last 150 years...
It actually was off scale. Professor.
Yeah, there have only been like three other incidents that even came close, but the biggest one was 150 years ago. So this is definitely one of the big ones. And, you know, it grazed us. And like I said, it knocked out two satellites, knocked out communications in certain areas.
But do you think we could be entering a period of time with some strange, unnatural output of the sun? In other words, I guess I'm asking, could it be perhaps not over yet?
Well, it's not over yet. There was another mini storm just 2 weeks ago, another aftershock.
Yes.
And these sunspots do rotate around the sun. You know, the sun flips its north pole and south pole every 11 years.
Yes,
and
sir.
The flipping of the poles sends a shockwave, and that shockwave creates the aurora borealis and the southern lights and the northern lights every 11 years. But this was kind of unexpected because this should be a quiet time for the sun, and it just goes to show you that the sun has a lot of tricks that we didn't quite anticipate.
Uh-huh.
And not to mention that the Earth's magnetic field is also beginning to decay.
Well, you know I meant to mention that, too. I just read a story.
It's 10% in the last century.
Yeah, much more. And then they're saying it could accelerate, too, and really accelerate.
Yeah, if the Earth's magnetic field were to go kaput, and like I said, it's dropped 10% already just in the last century, it would be quite dangerous. There'd be lots of radiation coming down from the sun.
We're almost talking the movie Core here.
However, we're not talking about destabilizing the center of the Earth.
But, I know, but magnetic field down, sun up, not good.
And also it could also mean that the poles may shift again. You know, the magnetic poles have shifted in the past. If you go to Hawaii and simply dig in the lava flows, you can actually see the magnetic pointing that was frozen in time many millions of years ago.
That also flipping. Possibly not good.
Yeah, so the poles could migrate, or the poles could gradually damp. This is all quite speculative. No one really knows for sure. But we do know that the Earth's magnetic field is dropping to a degree. And, within centuries to millennia, maybe it'll go to zero.
And on that note, Professor, we're out of time. I could go on forever. God, it's great to talk to you, and I'll look forward to doing it the next time. But we're out of time.
Mm-hmm.
We're out of time. Professor, thank you.
Okay. My pleasure. Anytime.
Good night.
Okay.
Here's Crystal. She's got all just exactly the right words to take us out of here. See you next time or next weekend, whichever comes sooner. I'm Art Bell. Good night.
Midnight in the desert, shooting stars across the sky. This magical journey will take us on a ride, filled with the longing, searching for the truth. Will we make it till tomorrow? Will the sun shine on you? Midnight in the desert.